Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 303 of the Roguecast, recorded September 8th, 2020.
Metro Little Pony!
Alright, we are coming to you this week, having just seconds ago watched the Star Trek Discovery trailer for Season 3.
Season 3. Is that kind of our only sort of news this week?
Yeah,
there's not a whole lot going on.
That's about it. There's not a ton of news this week.
Next week, we'll have, like, DC, we think, is going to have done their Fandome for comics.
We think Fandome Part 2 with comics.
So we'll have that. But in the meantime, Star Trek 3, so we've all enjoyed Discovery, right?
Yes. And we all love Set Lower Decks, right?
I don't know. I haven't watched any of it.
Nick might like it.
I believe we're always a trinity here, and I believe I like it.
Yep.
Nick has not watched it, and Dave despises it.
Yes, but and I don't despise it.
Knowing
but
my love for animation, and I've heard good things.
Yeah.
I will probably enjoy it on the level of.
Yeah, I'm actually rounding my appreciation up and Dave's down.
It is from.
I like it on bits and pieces, but don't overall like it. And I think, Dave, you like it in bits and pieces and don't overall like it.
Correct.
Because it's in the Next Generation era, right?
Yeah, it actually is set, like, right after more or less the last movie that they did.
Okay.
Or, like, you know, within 5 or 10 years of that. But that's the vibe. They're a second contact ship. They are meant to be a little bit of a loser ship. But there, it's not about the bridge crew. It is literally about the guys who are cleaning the ducts, repairing this and that. The guy Scotty is giving orders to. Those are the people that are the leads on the show. So sometimes they'll actually even do something where it's like the A plot is whatever would be going on in a regular Star Trek episode.
Uh-huh.
But for those characters, it's the B plot.
Yeah.
Their A plot is, are you going to ask that person out on a date or whatever?
Yeah. I can kind of get behind
it's
a show about the people's lives on a
Nick,
on
it's
a
also
Star
it's
Trek.
One of the guys who did Rick and Morty, and it
yeah.
feels very Rick and Morty. I feel like you will probably dig it more than me or Dave.
Yeah.
Because I like but don't love Rick and Morty, depending on the episodes, and I feel like I didn't want to apply to Star Trek. And Dave has a fondness for Star Trek that I think makes it hard to enjoy this. Although, weirdly, all the Next Gen fans we know seem to really like this.
Yeah, like I feel like it's going over pretty well with fandom. And it's not hurting me none, so I'm fine just kind of stepping back from it a little bit and letting people enjoy what they enjoy.
And I love all things Rick and Morty, so.
But we are all, we've all been fans of Star Trek Discovery.
It's my favorite Star Trek show right now.
And in the final episode of the second season, they did something that really Trek has never done as a running idea. Which is to say they catapulted the characters roughly 1,000 years into the future,
yep.
And that is where the entire, we think, season 3 will take place.
So before we talk about the trailer, I have one nit to pick about that.
Yeah.
They catapulted themselves into the future
yep.
from 1,000 years ago. So when they get to this future of 1,000 years, like, no way back, I'm like, you have technology from 1,000 years ago. You're telling me in 1,000 years no one's improved time travel technology? You're not going to get there and, like, here's your Mr. Fusion, you can go back now?
Well, it seems like things aren't
gone great.
Things have not gone great.
I guess my big question
Imagine somebody in the Industrial Revolution, Randy, who's like, our technology is so cool, let's jump forward to the year 2020 and see how great things are.
I mean, the technology's better.
Technology is better.
They didn't have iPhones in the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
They also didn't have a pandemic. That was a different pandemic.
Yeah. They had probably seen glimpses of fascism,
yeah.
But they thought, that's a European thing.
They jump forward and they're like, you guys are still dealing with a pandemic?
That's right.
Anyway, my question to you guys, before we get to the trailer, do you believe this is like, is it just season 3, or is it always going to be 1,000 years in the future? Will they go back at the end of this season?
Man, I don't know. That is a good question. The show has, in some ways, never quite lived up to its name, which sounds like they're really going to be charting new territory.
Yeah.
But
remind me, in the end of season 2, basically, doesn't the Federation, or Pike and Spock especially,
they disavow knowledge.
Yeah, they redact everything.
Right, because the Discovery had this experimental spore drive that allowed them to basically teleport around the universe.
Yep.
And, like, lots of fans were like, well, this show can't be canon because no one's ever mentioned a spore drive. And so their answer to that was, like, it became basically after it served its purpose, it was too dangerous to kind of keep around. They covered it up sort of X-Files style,
yeah.
And they had everybody, like, swear to secrecy.
And on the Discovery chose to stay on the Discovery because they had the option of getting off.
Right, yeah, and going to the Enterprise.
Right.
So,
right.
I and Dave, you may have more insight into this. Is this a thing where they didn't think fans would ask these questions? They're like, well, we want to do a prequel area series, and we're going to give them this cool technology. And then when all the fans ask, we're like, well, we got to answer this. Let's just shoot them to the future.
Yeah, I don't know the behind-the-scenes stuff, and of course they're not always candid about that. Right. They'll say they did something and they'll bend the truth to a different reason that sounds more positive.
It seems like a quintessential question. If you're going to create something, you know fans are diehard about something as big as your story is focusing on.
You have to pay attention to continuity. You can't just kind of like roll with it and just kind of be happy-go-lucky about it.
Yeah.
So I think that... Here's the thing that I was never sure about. You jump ahead 1,000 years and technology is going to change wildly. You know, Trek usually jumps forward 50 years, 100 years between its shows, or just 10 years or whatever, and they do flashbacks. They've never jumped forward that far, and it seems like it would be so alien that it may not feel like Star Trek.
Unless there's a dark age, and there's no technology, and people, and there's an age that goes by that people don't know how to use the technology.
And that seems to be
what happened. The case. Yeah, they call the burn happened, and it looks like it brought down the Federation with it.
Do you think it started where there was a gender reveal party on board a spaceship, and just the wildfire went out of control and destroyed the whole civilization?
I think they're like, it's consuming the star! Get out of here!
Yeah, but what gender is the baby?
So let's see. What did we see in the trailer? We see that it looks like the Discovery actually crashes on a planet's surface. It looked to me like they were like blasting at the ground, like they were maybe clearing away rubble, like in the split seconds before they hit, which was pretty dope.
And it looks like our main character is
Michael Burnham.
Burnham is not on the Discovery. She's in her little.
She's in the right angle suit. She's guiding them into the future.
Yep. Right. So she has like a crazy time travel high tech suit.
Yep.
It looks like clearly they're going to get aligned at some point, but.
Yeah.
First of all, there's going to be... It looks like there's survivalist stuff on planet surfaces.
Yep.
There's a broad arc that will probably be happening throughout the whole season about sort of maybe restoring the Federation.
Yep.
And the Federation's sort of ideals transcending the level of technology and, whether or not they have all of their... Whether they're geared up in, like, what do they call it? A post-scarcity setting in general in Star Trek. Maybe not so post-scarcity now. Post-scarcity. Back to scarcity.
We saw Andorians.
I saw an Andorian and a Trill. Deep Space Nine.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah, they got the spotted markings on the side of their face. That means it's probably a symbiote.
We saw some Burnham give some stirring speeches. Also,
There's a really good speech in there.
Her second, essentially. I'm blanking on all these people.
Saru, who was very briefly captain before Pike came in and kicked him to the curb.
And was he captain? Wasn't he captain when they were? Oh, they hadn't decided.
Yeah, they hadn't decided. And I say that to kind of just say that Burnham is our main character. I don't know if she's actually going to be captain.
Well, that's one of the things I want to mention about this, is that one of the themes, it seems like, of this trailer is that they're like a family now, and they're a crew, and it's the kind of thing that... In the first season, it was so focused on Burnham and a little bit of Tilly. They really didn't have the ensemble. The second season, they really amped up the look at the various ensemble characters.
Yeah. Right. Stamets and Tilly and all of those people, like, bonded.
And now hardcore. I buy them as a family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
but you know what's...
There's that great bit with the three... With the Tilly and Stamets and, with Jet Reno.
Yeah.
Where they're, like, talking about, no, we're dysfunctional. That's how it works.
Yeah. It's, well, you know what's interesting is... When they got to the Star Trek movies back in the day, prior to that, like, Chekhov and Uhura and Sulu and stuff like that, they had always kind of been just really, like, very one-note supporting characters. Memorable because the actors brought something to them, but, you know, they were lucky to get an episode kind of focused on them every once in a blue moon in their time. But once they got to the movies, especially Star Trek III, where they got to, like, steal the Enterprise, well, then they started having some fun with them. And then by Star Trek IV, when they went back and saved the whales, they were like a family. And Trek kind of, I think, realized at that point that beyond just the Kirk, Spock, McCoy, the idea of everybody on the bridge crew being really, we got your back, and we all really work well together and love each other, became a thing. And here they're kind of getting to that a little bit quicker, but it is by doing something of what the movies did, which was when you cut them off from the Federation and they only have each other to rely on, then that happens.
Yeah.
And that is exactly, you know, the situation they're in. They don't have all the support, so they got to be there.
fan. Discovery has also been action heavy since the outset, and it seems like that's not going to change. I thought the action sequences here looked really good.
There definitely seems to be a conflict that's still going on with whatever, and there's new characters introduced in the trailer.
One thing we did not see is like an overt like villain, I think.
Right, we don't know who the villains are.
Yeah, and it may be more of like a concept. You know, I always think of something like Batman No Man's Land as a cool storyline where there was no central villain to it. It was sort of like he was fighting for the soul of the city, but there was a million fires he had to put out.
Right.
And I kind of like the idea of that. I don't know that I need to see a villain, but since the show is serial format, they probably will build to something.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
But they at least right now are keeping that quiet. It looks more like survivalist.
No more rogue AIs, please.
Yes,
I think the what is it? Control.
Yeah, control.
Control, and probably to some extent they're ditching a lot of the first season stuff that people didn't like, which was the weird new Klingons. I think that's probably gone. How does this fit in continuity? That's all gone. Them having their own uniforms, like, all that makes more sense in A3.
They'll still find ways to screw up the continuity. I mean, honestly, they have...
anything in this era, in this era before?
Really?
Basically, there have been times because Enterprise had a temporal Cold War.
Oh, right.
And so they, there were glimpses at many times of the futures, but, you know, it's all kind of was stuff that was probably going to potentially shift depending on machinations in the present of then.
Enterprise,
so,
is that Scott Bakula? Or
that was like 100 years before Disco and
stuff. But there was time travel in that, too.
Does that mean we can get a Scott Bakula appearance?
I mean, that'd be cool.
I'd love it.
Yeah, they do a temporal Cold War reference and Scott Bakula's
Archer shows up. No, yeah. Scott Bakula the actor.
No, they need to give Quantum Leap his happy ending, so he is both Archer and Sam Bakula.
The ultimate, that would be the ultimate reveal.
Because I think with the first two seasons, fans were always waiting for some sort of connective tissue or a thing that they recognized as being kind of a big thing for them. Like the Tribble and in season two. And
I mean, Pike was pretty big in there.
And this season, just on its surface, I don't see anything that I would like overtly recognize that connects it to Star.
I mean, you notice the Andorian. There's like that's sort of trappings of them, but yes, there's no like a thousand years in the future is not an era that's really been written about. It's probably been glimpsed. I'm sure it's been you know, at some point, someone in Deep Space Nine said you know, there's some time travel thing and something got referenced. So it's not like it's complete unknown territory, but it's mostly unknown territory.
The notion of the Fallen Federation is interesting to me.
Yeah.
The notion of the galaxy having to come back to those ideals is interesting. I don't know why...
What would lead people to think about rebuilding?
I don't know why there'd be any kind of thematic resonance in that right now. I have no idea. Can't think of anything.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we'll just have to see if we end up connecting with it.
Right. Anyway, I think we all were pretty into this trailer.
Yeah. Good first trailer. And by the way, this is like... Today is like Star Trek Fan Day, and they're doing some other stuff. So there may be more things, which we'll talk about next week as we learn more.
Right. All right, but we are not a Star Trek podcast. Contrary to what the last 10 minutes might have told you.
Nope.
We are actually...
Now, Text Trek. There's a Star Trek podcast. People should...
Text Trek?
Yeah.
What's that, Dave?
Text-Trek. That is the podcast which I normally participate in, except when they're doing episodes about Lower Decks. But I'm all ready for Disco when it shows up. Yeah. But anyway... I digress.
Store news, there's not a ton right now. We just want to mention that Marvel Champions did get its first big expansion with Rise of the Red Skull, which has, I think, four villains and, like, a story pack and, I think, a couple heroes. And
it comes with Hawkeye and Spider-Woman.
Hawkeye and Spider-Woman,
really cool.
So, yeah, I've been buying those dutifully, and I've not played a single one of them yet, but I will at some point. But, yeah, if you've been waiting for that, that came in this week. Okay. Let's talk about comics I guess we'll take a break, as is traditional, and then we'll talk about comics of the week.
Sounds good.
We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, September 9th, and I don't want to say we've gotten back to normal, but we are starting to see, like, some new comics come in.
Yeah.
First issues, that kind
of
stuff.
We've gotten used to our somewhat odd schedule of DC releases Tuesday, everything else releases Wednesday.
Although this week DC came in late because of Labor Day.
But only, like, by an hour or two.
Yeah, not
so
too
in
bad.
Other words,
not too bad.
I think almost all of this stuff, and any pains going on behind the scenes, and they are going on behind the scenes.
Oh, they are.
Are hopefully invisible to you, the listener and customer and friend.
Except when you come in and say, how's it going? And we groan and fall unconscious.
Yes.
Then you're like, oh, something might be up.
Think they got the Rona.
So one of the books that came out this week, I've been super looking forward to because I went in on the art book. I talked about that previously. I'm super looking forward to the game. And that is Cyberpunk 2077 Trauma Team number 1. This is a 4-issue mini from Dark Horse by Cullen Bunn and Miguel Valderrama.
Would this be considered sort of a side story to the video game?
Actually, I'm not sure if it's even... I think it's just in that world.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, this is about a trauma team, which for those who don't know, they basically have this flying ambulance that they fly around the city in, and rich people or rich edge runners, what they call the cyberpunk people.
People that have contracts with them.
Yeah, they have a platinum contract, which means not only do you get the best healthcare, but they will send in an armed response team to pull you out of whatever situation has got you into trouble.
Right. Like, say you are hacking into some database and a bunch of dudes come gunning for you and there's a giant firefight. You can call this in and this hover thing will come in. Randy, I was laughing a minute ago behind the scenes because you said flying ambulance, and like I'm looking at the art and there's this really awesome futuristic Blade Runner looking like hover vehicle, but when you say flying ambulance, I just picture like a dumbass modern ambulance like with a space shuttle jet stuck to the edge of it.
It has a cooler name, I don't know what it is, so I said flying ambulance.
Yep, no. the art in this is super good.
This is like Blade Runner meets Shadowrun.
Yeah. Meets Neuromancer and anything other cyberpunk that's so
I know
formative.
Nothing of the cyberpunk world.
People jack into things.
Yeah, but what I was going to say...
And then they hack the nets.
What I was going to say is, you don't need it. I basically plugged into this from page one, and I found it to be very entertaining.
It's sort of military-esque.
Yeah.
They all have these cool armored suits. They have their names on the back of them. And it focuses on one paramedic... soldier, basically, who survives the wipeout of her team and going back into the field.
What's interesting about, like, nearly all cyberpunk-type futures are morally gray.
Yep.
People are... It's like you're either working for, like, a megacorporation or a rival of the megacorporation,
yep.
But there's almost nobody who's, like, straight-up white hats.
Yep.
Now, sometimes you do, like, there's elements of that in almost everything, but these trauma teams are sort of, I guess I'd say, apolitical. They go out to the highest bidder. It is like a medical team of, mercenary medics.
Yep.
And they do touch on this notion in this of, like, well... What happens if you're pulling out somebody who's maybe not so good?
Yeah.
But the focus of the issue is on just like what happens when a job goes as a rough one.
Yeah.
And that's kind of this first issue, which is very moment by moment. But the framing device is kind of neat because it's like a person who's they're going back into the field and they're getting interviewed about the incident. And so the interview overlays the actual incident as you see it.
It's good. Right. I mean, Cullen Bunn's a good writer. The art is great. I was on board for this. I was kind of hoping it'd be good, and it turned out to be good.
So. Yeah, I don't think Nick and I especially had like a big, strong feelings about it. And I am like a casual cyberpunk fan at best. Don't know this particular cyberpunk setting, but I found it a really good, approachable first issue.
I like Cullen Bunn. I will pretty much read anything he does at this point.
The Big Bun Man is always a high level of craft.
I didn't get a chance to read it, but I did want to mention that Bill and Ted Are Doomed came out this week.
Mm-hmm.
It's Evan Dorkin going back to writing Bill and Ted, which he wrote a lot of stuff for Marvel.
And I think back before, back before funny, like, humor comics were kind of funny, he kind of did one of the earliest ones, Latin, like The Tick and stuff like that in the 80s, that was.
And this one is also, I guess, a direct lead into the movie, which I really enjoyed, so worth a look.
Oh, yeah.
Nick? I think we've been looking forward to this Web of Venom Wraith that came out this week.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, Wraith was a cool character that showed up in Annihilation. You reminded us that he was created by Javier Grill...
Marshwatch. The guy who did Middleman.
Yes. And really has sort of sat in kind of stasis since then.
Yeah, I mean,
He was in one issue or a few panels of Donnie Cates' Guardians, which I only knew because it was referenced in this one shot.
But
Wraith as a cosmic character is defined almost more than anything else by his look. He looks like space version of the Man with No Name.
Correct.
He's even got a poncho.
He's a bounty hunter.
He's a Kree bounty hunter that has something akin to the symbiotes that he's
so
attached to.
Of course, Donnie Cates, who is redoing all this in symbiote mythology, would bring it in and did a good job of it.
Yeah. The art is fun. I wish it was Kyle Hotz.
Of course.
Because he draws the Wraith like no other.
But he looks...
Oh,
that's cool.
Oh,
art.
I'm not disparaging the art.
No, you disparaged it.
Did I disparage? I'm sorry.
This is Guy Villanova, and I actually think he's pretty great.
Yeah. the facial stuff and just the level of detail he gets.
It reminds me of like artists like a little bit like Steve Epting and Butch Geist and those kind of guys.
Totally see that.
Basically, all those people who worked on Winter Soldier and stuff.
But Kate finds a natural way to tie him into Null and the oncoming apocalypse.
Null, the symbiote god.
Yes, yep. Null, the symbiote god, and the incoming apocalypse that Null will bring to Earth inevitably, I'm sure, is coming.
Yep, and does a big reveal that I think will tie into Venom as we go forward.
Yep.
Also, Eddie is only in this for a couple panels. I have not been keeping up with Donny Cates' Venom, but he has turned Eddie into a bearded metal-looking dude.
I mean,
that is what Donny Cates does. He comes in, he bears you up, he metals you.
Yeah,
all right.
He needs to take over like the least metal comic there is. I'm going to say Squirrel Girl and and Metaller.
I think Donny Cates' Legion of Superheroes would be great.
Yeah.
Let's give him My Little Pony. See what he does with that.
Metal Little Pony.
you practically just rearrange the words. My little is metal. Yeah. And then my little.
Yep.
My Metal Pony.
My Metal Pony. we like that. Marvel also has a new license, The Rise of Ultraman. This is their. As Dave is also always being confused, Ultraman, of course, at DC is like the evil Superman.
Right, yes. He's from Earth 2 or whatever.
This is not that guy. This is the 1960s era kaiju fighting guy in suit.
Yeah, the Japanese sort of superhero who can grow giant and fight kaiju, and he's got like the silver and red costume and the sort of insectoid, almost Ant-Man helmet. It's a cool look.
So I have no attachment to Ultraman whatsoever.
Yep.
But this first issue, it's by Kyle Higgins. Well, it's several people, but the main story is by Kyle Higgins and some guy whose name is Groom, who reminds me of sort of a... I don't know, Stuart Immonen. It's good. It's really good
it
art.
Is. It's like Stuart Immonen, Leonard Kirk.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And it follows a girl who is working for this underground place called, what, UFG? Something like that? USP, the United Science Patrol. And she is apparently very good at like dealing with weird technology. She has a guy, she's going out in the field for the first time. She has a friend who failed out of the exam and wanted in, and who somehow can still remember. Apparently, most people don't remember what they see when they see kaiju or the United Science Patrol. There's a bit of a Men in Black vibe to it.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's going to be a... the Ultraman stuff doesn't actually show up till the very end. It is actually a... It's about these guys who are fighting kaiju quietly in our world. And I love that
So is
setup.
He going to be kind of the secret weapon in the war against the kaiju?
That's what it looks like. It looks like basically this... this kid who is like the outsider who they wouldn't let him in the he's too much of a wild card to be on the team might merge with Ultraman and become their Ultraman.
So I do want to correct you, Randy.
Yes.
Kyle Higgins and Matt Groom are the writers.
Oh, okay.
And the artist for the main story is Francesco Mana.
You're right. Yep.
And also there's some other artwork by people you will definitely recognize, like
Ed McGuinness,
Michael Cho,
and Guri Hiro.
Yep.
Yeah. So there's some backup stories. There's something called Kaiju Steps, produced by the United Science Patrol's People and Culture Division, which is basically their little...
is that like a... I love his film. Is that like a Mr. DNA?
Yes.
From
like
a
Mr. DNA for the Kaiju.
True.
Yeah.
It's basically talking to the various patrolmen and like, remember this about Kaiju? They're not dinosaurs. Even they look like dinosaurs. That's kind of fun. There's a little preview image from Ed McGuinness. And then there's a backup story called that takes place in 1954 Paris... about a couple of USP agents by Michael Cho, which has like a, not black and white, but not sepia tone, but like the gray version of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it's what looks like old, it looks like old footage or like TV footage. It looks like black and white.
I didn't read the Kaiju Steps because I was running out of time.
Yeah.
But there is a line of dialogue I have to read.
Okay.
One of them, the main character, I guess, is talking. He says, "My hands, they have become discourteous lobsters."
Yeah.
They very much have become discourteous
lobsters.
He's
not lying.
I've just never heard anybody expound that their hands have become such things.
Also, popping your uniform's collar looks cool, but it's not permitted. Anyway, this was super fun, and actually, I kind of skimmed through the other stuff, and now I kind of want to read it. Okay, there is two Empire Fallout things this week. Empire ended last week. There is an Avengers Empire Aftermath by Dan Slott, or by Al Ewing, and there is a Fantastic Four Empire Fallout by Dan Slott, dealing with the various threads. So, the Empire Aftermath is basically a one-shot of Hulkling and Wiccan's space marriage, and the setting up of what the Kree Skrull Empire is going to look like after this.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked this.
Yeah.
I thought it was a lot of good, fun moments, and sets up an interesting sort of space adventure for the future. Also, all the Young Avengers are in it, which was kind of cool. They go back, and there's a point in which Captain America is like, can you believe we tried to stop them from being Avengers? That was dumb of us, and I liked that.
Yep.
There's some really good stuff in that. And then the Empire of Fallout Fantastic Four is more of a check-in with the two, like, the young Kree and Skrull Warrior, and is it the Empress? Someone else? The Profiteer? So this is all, like, basically all the Fantastic Four stuff they've been doing. They check in on that, and there's also a big change with the Watcher, who, as you might remember, is currently Nick Fury.
Right. That was the strange effect of... What was that called? That was the hammer thing.
Original Sin.
Original Sin.
No, not the hammer thing. That was Fear Itself.
That Fear Itself. Original Sin was a different thing.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, there were some rough crossovers from Marvel.
Yeah.
We don't have those on our shelf for reasons. Yeah, so anyway, both of those are good follow-ups through the Empire. In particular, the Empire one, the Avengers one, I would say, even if you weren't reading Empire, if you're a Young Avengers fan, you probably want to give that one a look.
You know, I was just flipping through this week's Marauders, issue number 12.
Yep.
So there's something that's pretty notable that happens in that.
Yeah?
Yeah. Randy, I guess I don't want to say what it is, but a customer, a certain customer of ours...
Oh my God, she'll be so happy.
...will be extremely happy with this development. if it is what it looks like, and it may or may not quite be based
right.
on
You're
what I saw.
You're talking about Kitty's hand tattoos, right?
Yes.
Kill Shaw.
Those actually are the literal tattoos she gets there?
Well, I mean, about six episodes ago, Shaw killed her, so...
I mean, I guess you'd feel that way, but, you know, once you get your payback, aren't you going to kind of feel a little awkward?
Here's the thing. She's a mutant. She's going to die and come back with a new body.
That's true.
Well, that was the thing. She can't use the gates, and she couldn't be resurrected until they figured it out, which was a cool reveal, actually, on why she wasn't.
So now she's not going to be a pirate anymore.
But she wants to be a pirate. She's gone full pirate.
Why couldn't she use the gates?
It's a spoiler. It's a really good reveal, and I don't want... I will tell you off mic.
All right.
So Marauders also came out this week.
Yep.
There's also a DC book that I wanted to mention, just because I think people will flock to it, it's Dark Knight's Death Metal Trinity Crisis.
Yep.
I didn't get a chance to read it, but it is notable because it's Francis Manapul doing artwork for the entire issue, and Manapul is an amazing artist, just the way he does layouts and everything. But this one focuses on, I guess... the real versions of Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman in this Dark Knight's future.
Well, they're all metalheads.
And it definitely references some crazy things like Barbatos.
Barbatos is like a bat demon or something,
bat
right?
Bat demon, yes. And also...
I thought that was the thing you took if you had an upset tummy.
No, that's where you would go if you want to go vacationing and swim in tropical seas.
Jonah Hex is involved. There's even a reference to... or there's even a Superboy Prime involved. So... definitely if you've been...
Don't bring the book down, Nick.
Hey, some people like Superboy Prime.
At least one.
if you're enjoying Dark Knight's Death Metal, this is probably something that is going to be important to the overall story that you're going to want, since it's actually written by Scott Snyder.
Just from what I've read, there was also, like, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman were pretty key players to all of this. Batman is, like, especially central. But if this zeroes in on them, that seems like it'd be pretty notable.
All I'm saying is Wonder Woman on the cover has a cosmic chainsaw that's doing Kirby Crackle, and I kind of dig that.
Yep. That's been her thing.
There's also two trades I want to mention. One is Owly Volume 2, Just a Little Blue, which is the second of the all-ages Owly books from Scholastic.
Are these the colorized versions?
Full-color versions, yeah. And then the collection of Outer Darkness Chew, the miniseries that turned out to be the finale of the Outer Darkness series, as well as a nice coda for the Chew series, leading into them going back and doing CHU Chew, which is a preview or a prequel to the Chew series.
Right.
Anyway.
It all makes sense.
It's sort of fun sci-fi, and if you like either of those books, I would highly recommend it.
And I feel like the people who like one of those books would probably like the other. They're both the quirkier side of genre comics, but also kind of real approachable and funny and cool and weird.
Yep. Also kind of fun to see John Layman and Rob Guillory working together again.
Yeah.
Alright, I think that's it for comics this week, unless I missed anything.
I don't think so.
Alright, we're going to come back in just a second to talk about some TV and some movies. Or a movie. I don't know. So, I hear that Disney released some kind of movie.
You know, they are in a constant state of releasing things even during a quarantine pandemic-y time.
Yeah.
And they, with the live-action Mulan, they kind of broke some new ground with this one.
Say, this is fairly notable in the grand scheme of things because, at least in the North American market, they're bypassing movie theaters. Which
yeah.
has caused a little
bad
bit of
day
for
movie theaters.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be like a big IMAX release. They were going to do all this. It's clearly like a visually spectacular movie.
I can verify that on my big screen.
I bet. I bet. And, but yeah, they, so what did, Nick, for Disney Plus people, what was the final way it played out to get this if you wanted
so
to watch it?
You have to be a member of Disney Plus, which is like the $6.99 a month or whatever it is.
Right.
It's actually fairly cheap for what it for a streaming.
Oh yeah,
service.
It's like one of the best priced ones.
But then you have to get Premier Access, which is you pay $30
one time.
Yeah, one time, and you get access to you basically get Mulan 3 months ahead of time because they are going to do a general release in December. And so just go straight to Disney Plus.
Oh, interesting, interesting.
So this is just for the benefit of watching it early.
Are there any numbers in at all on this yet?
So I haven't seen like actual numbers other than the fact that I think Disney reported that subscribers since Mulan went live has been up like 68%. Which, if that's true,
okay.
that is fairly notable.
Well, yeah, weren't they at like a billion? They had a ton of
yeah.
viewers before that.
If like X amount of people paid the $30, I honestly could see them earning maybe not their full money back, but they're probably pretty happy with how it happened.
So
how it ended
I'm just
up.
Saying, it sounds like it's time to release Black Widow.
Well, and that actually is the hypothesis that people are kind of coming to. It's like, they hit a huge amount of money with Mulan.
Yep.
Why don't they release it?
Yep.
I mean, I just spent $30 on Mulan. I'd probably spend $30 on Black Widow.
I would spend $30 on Black Widow.
But you didn't spend it on Mulan.
No, I did not.
But let's get back to Mulan. Because it is notable.
Yep. So, I think you and I both liked this.
I thought it was really good. I was talking with my wife a little bit about it, and I think we came to the conclusion that it is probably the best of the live-action movies.
I was thinking that for me, my top three are this, Jungle Book, and Aladdin. Those are my personal top three.
Yeah, I think that those are sort of the best. I know Aladdin is not beloved by everyone.
It's too bad.
Aladdin's great.
There's so much going for it.
It is. It is.
But, like, I know sometimes people are like, well, you know, Will Smith actually doesn't have, like, the vocal range of...
That's fair.
Of,
yeah.
of what's the name. Like, there's reasonable criticisms, but I felt like, as far as striking a balance between new and old, that was a good one that was a little more traditional.
Right.
Jungle Book was, like, basically a wholly original story. And then Mulan is almost, or is as revolutionary in the sense that it kind of... dropped all singing and dancing, all the sort of lighter elements. Not that there's no comedy in it at all. It's still Disney,
yeah.
But it like turned it into more of what would be a traditional kind of like big fantasy period piece thing, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon,
yeah.
or House of Flying Daggers, or one of those movies.
But it definitely follows the story of Mulan,
right? Which is a Chinese folk tale
yep.
about a sort of a you know everybody who's I'm sure seen the cartoon knows the deal, but. About a woman who, like, there's a conscription going on to, like, fight. I think it was, like, the Hun or whatever
In the animated one.
And here, there's more, like, these nomadic raiders. And the story is a little bit different. But,
yeah.
But in essence, the conscription is the important thing. Everybody has to deliver one son to go and fight in the army against them. This guy has no sons. He's got two daughters. And Mulan, who is, you know, what would be tomboyish in other terms...
They make out early on in the beginning of the movie that chi is a big thing,
right?
And
she has
and
this potent
everyone,
life force.
Yeah, not everyone has sort of access and can harness their chi, but Mulan is different. She
in practical terms, it is what allows her to do the kind of wire fu stunts, the wuxia type martial arts moves,
and they out straight out do magic. I mean,
right.
there is a the person
since this
who is
a folk tale and not a historical tale. I don't think it's too crazy to do that.
There's a woman. What's interesting is beyond the dragon and the gods, there's not magic in the original Mulan, the animated one.
Nope.
I guess not. But a dragon is pretty magic.
There is a woman who is helping sort of the evil guy.
Like, this is a new character.
New character completely, and I honestly think she's one of the best.
She
parts
ends
of
up
the care,
becoming
of the
a real asset to it. And early on, I kind of was worried she was not going to be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the bad guy who, honestly, he's a very fun kind of, like, traditional bad guy with a scarred face, a really cool black costume. He is a scary Attila the Hun-looking dude. And I dig his look.
Yeah.
I got to say, he looked like a guy who was having fun being bad. And then you have, I'm not going to be able to remember the name of the sorceress.
I can't remember it either.
But she's sort of a witch, sort of working at his behest, and I really actually liked how they kind of did her powers, where she did stuff that's not normally, like, kind of like in, like, Western, like, movies. Like, she'll, like, would turn into, like, a flock of bats.
Zhen Lang? Is that possible?
Is the character name?
Yeah, it's the character name. Gong Li is the actress.
Yeah, Gong Li is the actress.
Okay, yeah. But she'll, like... Like, she's attacking the regiment of troops at one point, and they've got these shields up, and, like, these swarms of bats are battering them, and they're just, like, terrorized by them. And I'm like, normally bats are not used so offensively as that, but they were like, we are going to lose because of these bats.
Well, she, like, transforms into a hawk a lot, and then...
And the hawk is the dangerous
shape. She actually, like, keeps the hawk talons as sort of a fighting implement.
Although this is relatively bloodless, as far as, like, literal depiction of blood, people do die.
Yes.
And, like, you'll see, like, her gouge somebody, and they'll fall to the ground, and you're like, oh, they're dead. It is not... So it was a change-up from the Disney story in that sense. You'll see people stabbed by spears. It's not super violent the way they do it, but it does happen.
It also gets rid of the sort of love interest character... The one who basically, like, trains them is...
And this one is
played by Donnie Yen.
Yeah.
I heard that.
And he is kind of
There is still a love interest type character.
There is.
But it doesn't play out the same way.
Correct.
Like, I think... I actually have not seen the original in so long, and I'm not one of those people who was, like, completely in love with it. I enjoy it.
It's high on my Disney, just because...
I saw it for the first time this year.
Nick, where did it rank for your wife, the original?
Pretty high as well.
And yet y'all still both like this, which removes a lot of its stuff.
Yeah, there's no Mushu. One of Kaylee's friends will not watch it because it doesn't have Mushu, and I'm like, pet little tiny dragon, whatever. There is a representation of something in this movie like Mushu, which I thought was really cool. Which is the phoenix.
Oh, right.
Sort of like the ancestral... representation of their family is like their crest essentially is the phoenix.
Right. So you do see any number of times a representation of it.
Yeah, which I thought was a way to cool mirror Mushu, but not have sort of the wacky adventures because.
Right. Definitely there's no wacky in this
there's
movie.
There's none.
There's a little clowning because the goofy troops that she trains with, which are, kind of are iconic and silly in the original one, but. I don't know if the names are the same, but there's still a group of kind of like a small group within their army unit that hangs out. And I enjoyed all of those characters.
And there's still antics of her, keeping her gender a secret and things like that. But
right, and so, some of which is even played for humor, but absolutely, even more so, I'm sure, than it was in the 90s, there's an awareness now of gender fluidity.
Yep.
And I think the movie was generally sensitive to it. I certainly cannot be the one to probably speak to this ultimately, but I felt like they were probably being more sensitive and thoughtful. Certainly there was discussions of things like, this is your true self, and sort of terminology that I think would carry some weight now for people who are finding their gender identity.
I thought she was a great Mulan.
She was. The actress herself...
I basically had to sort of view those as two separate things.
I know.
It's tough to do in this day and age.
It was tough for me, too. Basically, she was sort of did a support the repressive government kind of thing during recent democracy protests.
Yeah.
Well, that's a tough one.
What it comes down to at that point is everybody's flawed at some point. You have to decide where your line is. Everybody's got a different line for what
I know some people had similar issues with past stuff for Gal Gadot.
Yep.
And she was also a person who, like, from when I kind of poked into that, who seem to have broadened her perspective.
Yeah.
And I feel like this actress is so young that I'm not going to, like, I don't feel quite okay throwing her to the wolves.
Everybody
for being young and dumb.
Yeah, maybe. That's true.
But you were talking about her acting ability and her personification of the character, and yes, I think she's great in it. I think they found the right person for the role.
I was a little surprised to see Jet Li as the Emperor.
You know what? I didn't even know that's who that was.
Yeah.
I don't watch enough martial arts movies to instantly identify him.
Definitely a little older than I remembered him the last.
Yeah. But he gets some fun stuff in it. You know what I liked in this was some of the crazy... There's not, like... So, like, not everybody uses their chi in it and, like, is able to do crazy stunts. A lot of it are, like, you'll see archers firing bows, normally. You'll see sword fights that are normal, if a little heightened in their style. But some people will do things like run up walls. And it looks so cool when they do it. Actually, the first ones that do it, I was like, oh, those guys are badasses.
There's some archery moves in this one that I was like, never seen that.
You're talking about one of the scenes with in the last battle.
Yeah.
And now it's super cool. It's because it kind of comes out of nowhere.
I'm like, Legolas couldn't even do that.
Yeah, it was a dope-ass move. The fight scenes in it are really cool. The sequence I was talking about with the bats where they're, like, harrying the unit, I don't want to say how that plays out, but what happens there, Nick, because I haven't seen the cartoon in a while, was that at all in the cartoon?
Nope.
The
nope.
kind of... way out of that sequence.
No, that was an entirely...
Because that was cool, in addition to being pretty visually spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah, the visuals in this are fantastic. There's kind of wide shots of...
Lots of really beautiful vistas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, weirdly, I found that the colors in it were a little garish at times. Some of the villager costumes were a little too bright to me. I know that, like, they're sort of like... I don't like it when movies just make everything... brown and gray, you know, like in any sort of medieval setting.
With, like, the Imperial City, like the main.
I think because, like, the folks in the kind of like the area where she lives, which are, I don't know, middle class, like a middle class area. They had sort of really some really bright and lively outfits. And I'm not, like, looking for either, you know, these kind of heightened movies like this and Crouching Tiger always amplify things and they always change them. I just thought that they were slightly garish, you know, the bright greens and yellows and oranges and reds and stuff. Just a little heightened there. But interestingly, as time went on, as they're kind of out in the army, there's less of that. And so I like the color palette better in the latter half of the movie.
There are kind of musical cues that do kind of... echo the songs.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, there were a couple of them.
So, by the way, the training sequence, which has the most famous song in the movie, in the Disney one, I didn't notice it.
Yeah.
But I did find that what's important to me is a training montage has to be energetic and cool, and it was energetic and cool.
I like the notion of them giving Mulan a sister. That was not in the movie, and it was a nice addition to see their relationship.
There's a little bit of Disney-ish kind of clowning around early on that has to do with Mulan kind of trying to be a proper woman.
Which was in the... That was, like,
interesting.
From the original
cartoon. And the sort of disapproving glances and
the
stuff
matchmaker.
She gets. Yeah, that's interesting. You know what's interesting now that I think about it is also how they do handle relationships and stuff in this. And what they kind of do and don't do as far as, like, traditional Disney romance-y stuff. But I wish I could remember. I guess I need to watch the original because I don't know quite how that worked either. What happened? Let me just ask. What happens in the original?
What? At the end?
Yeah. Is there, like, any overt romantic thing in it?
Yeah. There's a romance with Mulan and
the training guy,
which is voiced by... I think it's voiced by Donny Osmond, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, it's true.
Yeah, there was a romance there.
No one's more Chinese than Donny Osmond. But he did get the... You know what? I have respect for Donny Osmond, and, you know, that casting choice may look a little bit awkward in today's light, and I definitely get that. But... He's a great singer.
Yeah.
He sings the best song in it. He happened to get the best song. And if you've never seen him doing his background sequence when they show him dancing to White and Nerdy for Weird Al, by all means, pull up the video to that shows when they did their first take. It's super great.
And I don't know if it was last minute or if they just always intended it, but Ming-Na Wen does have a cameo in the movie. And she's notable because she voiced the original Mulan.
Oh, that's cool.
And it is really cool seeing her. I always like Ming-Na Wen, so...
You know, in the early half of the movie, there was a few story beats that felt to me a little too Disney, maybe some of the lighter stuff, and I kind of wanted it to be even more of a pure kind of Japanese, you know, fantasy epic like Crouching Tiger.
Yeah.
And basically, by the time that she's left the city, I started warming to it considerably, and then by the end, I was like, I really like this.
Yeah.
It's not that I blame Disney for being Disney. Like it has a certain brand and style, and that is, it would be crazy for them not to bring some of that to it. But they do go deeper into the style of Chinese movie, you know, action cinema than I expected them to.
Is it worth the $30? I think that's subjective. I mean, I'm glad I watched it.
The answer for you was yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
The answer for Dave was no.
In the sense that that I piggybacked on Nick's Disney, yes. But I will say, I think
sure I'm not the only one who did that this time.
It was probably, I do think that, like, it's that, what was that, is it, as a movie, is that worth a $30 thing? Yeah, I think so.
I think
Disney came through on it. And for me, it's probably like second place. I still think I like Jungle Book best, but
supersedes Aladdin though for you.
Yeah, I think Aladdin is in place three.
Oh, okay.
But it's a pretty hotly contested top three.
Out of curiosity, have you guys seen the Beauty and the Beast live action?
Yeah.
I watched it this week.
Uh-huh.
It is too long.
It's a little bit too long.
The additional songs I don't think are particularly good. And honestly, I think that not having animation, you don't get the character, everyone in there, from Gaston to Cogsworth, to, like, all those characters, even with, like, Ewan McGregor playing the Candelabra, whatever his name.
Oh, yeah.
Lumiere.
Cogsworth is played by Magneto.
Yes, in...
Magneto. I even with all that, like, the animation in that was so good, and the exploration, like, I missed a lot of that stuff. That said, I think there's some interesting stuff in there. I think they did a good job of giving her a little more agency.
Yeah.
Of her falling in love with him because he was a reader, not, like, his library of books isn't just a library he happens to have. He's read them all, and so she doesn't fall for him because he kidnapped her. She falls for him because he did have, like, he's a book learning people.
Like, they connect as people.
And there's some tweaks that I really like.
I was going to say, there are evolutions in these live-action stuff that makes sense, and I'm glad that they're there.
That said, in general, I think Beauty and the Beast would rank pretty low on my live-action remakes.
Well, I tried to watch it one time, and I couldn't get into it.
Yeah.
This is weird. Who plays her? Who plays
Emma
Belle?
Emma Watson.
Yeah.
So Emma Watson. So everybody knows she was great as Hermione.
Yep.
I don't know if I've really seen her in many other roles, or any other roles, maybe, except for this one. I'm not sure if she, as an actress overall, if she, like, engages me a lot.
I've seen her be good and stuff, and I like her as a person.
I'm trying to remember what all I
know. And, like, as a person, she seems awesome.
I know she's, I just don't know if I, like... Circle, which I watched that. Sort of
what?
Did she
circle? It was that weird kind of Tom Hanks.
She needs to go to, like, the Christina Ricci. Who's the other girl? Who's the girl from the vampire Twilight movies?
Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart. She needs to do the indie circuit route like they did.
Yeah, I think she might have it because why we've seen a lot of this.
No, maybe so. Maybe so.
Anyway, moving on from Disney to the complete opposite end of the spectrum. Nick and I have been watching The Boys season 2.
Yes.
This is over on Prime. They released the first 3 episodes of season 2, and I guess they're going to go week to week after that.
Yeah, which is a change up from the last season.
Which is a mistake, I feel, but...
I don't think it is.
I want to watch it all.
You know, I agree with that, and a part of me does, but also...
Just want to gorge on it.
I do.
But also, I think HBO and sort of its resurgence with Prestige TV of, like, Watchmen and Lovecraft Country... I'm kind of nostalgic for that once a week kind of thing.
Yeah, Randy, well, you watch it once a week, Nick, and we'll all binge.
You do a TV podcast, Randy. Don't you like talking about TV? You get this whole week in between each one to talk about each episode?
No, I want to watch it all one time and then move on to whatever's next.
You're a little greedy guts.
I am a little greedy guts. No, I think that's what it is. It's like, look, I have time to binge this show now. If you drop it out every week, I've already talked about it, and I can't justify it in my TV dude slot. Like, this is now leisure time TV, which I don't make as much time for as work TV, which I know is weird, but that's the way my brain works. So binge, I'm a binge mode person. Don't get me wrong, I am loving Lovecraft Country every week, but I would be much happier if they dropped all of it and I could watch
it. You could just devour it and then vomit it up after your full meal.
Exactly. I wanna binge and purge.
Well, I hear that, Randy, then maybe you should go join the people that are review bombing it at IMDb or whatever.
Yeah, screw those people. yeah, the position of the rogue cast is Lovecraft Country is awesome.
And the position, for me at least, is Boys is awesome.
I really liked... I am not a huge fan of the comic.
No, I don't like the comic at all.
And I think that they did a great job of season one of making it something... You noticed it was Eric Kripke who did the Supernatural. It was really fun. Their character stuff is great. Homelander is this complete psychopath who you still kind of feel like a little empathy for. Not bad for.
You see where he's coming
from. You see where he's coming from. Yeah. That's exactly right. That is a difficult balancing act to hit, and I think he does a great job.
Well, the cool thing is that no one in this show is good.
No, they're all
terrible. They all have flaws. They're all terrible. Even the main character,
even
Huey.
Huey,
who is the most sort of relatable, and in the first, even the second episode, he kills one of the most popular superheroes,
and he also makes huge mistakes. Like he is, he's sort of like a little bit anxious and neurotic, and
you know,
and makes mistakes that way.
I have neither read the comic nor seen this show, although I'm wanting to check out the show. I don't mind spoilers, but I want to check it out. But those sound like themes that fit Garth Ennis's general, vibe. Like, people screwing up and having to own up to them.
Yep.
Or having to bear up the weight of, like, their screw-ups and stuff like that.
Yep.
That sounds like the kind of themes he does.
It is. It's just, it's done with a little more deafness than Ennis has been in the last few years.
Ennis has a very specific speed.
Yeah.
Like, always kind of, always the same.
Yep.
But with the second season, it's... starts up after the cliffhanger of the last one.
Yeah,
we get a little bit more of that.
Yeah, the big the
does
big
it jump
reveal...
between basically these guys who are like, because you've got like, is it still like a British group?
Yeah, more or less. No, they're someone.
There's
American,
a French.
There's
yeah,
a French
American.
One,
there's
American.
A Frenchman.
Okay, and they're kind of there to somewhat keep superheroes from in check.
Well, they're basically they're anti superhero vigilantes, but they are very much the. If the superheroes noticed them, they would squash them kind of thing. There's a reason why...
They keep under the radar?
There's a reason why Billy Butcher is alive, which we got sort of revealed this season.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the supers are more amused by their existence. Like, Homelander's like, they're not a real threat. He doesn't take them seriously.
Well, I mean, they definitely work... They've worked with the CIA in the past. At least
right.
Billy has.
Yes, yes.
And so is Mother's Milk and Frenchie. Yeah.
These names are ridiculous, by the way.
They are, but...
Those are Garth Ennis names. What's their goal? If you had to sum up what their...
Billy Butcher hates superheroes.
Specifically Homelander, which is their Superman.
Uh-huh.
And he is...
And does what does he hate him for?
It's a long story.
Okay.
But it deals with Billy's wife.
Okay, so this is like that's his personal reason. I wondered if there was like a... Like, in the comic, I know that they kind of seem to represent, like, the worst aspects of American... arrogance and hedonism and all that stuff.
No, they're not really. They're not really going to that theme. I mean,
interesting.
They're a corporate. They represent corporate evil, if anything.
And the first season is definitely some hedonism and what they do was in their downtime.
Yeah.
And kind of what you might imagine superheroes would do.
But the thrust of really is that there's this illegal drug that gives them powers, and that has been outed.
Ah, interesting.
And that is sort of... And that the company is a pharmaceutical company, not a superhero company.
Mm-hmm.
Superheroes are basically PR.
Yep.
And Giancarlo Esposito plays the head of it, and
he's
great.
We barely saw in the first season. He was in one episode.
Yeah.
In this one, he's in multiple, and he is like in full force. He's an amazing actor.
Yeah. He's great. They also bring a new character called Stormfront. Played by Aya Cash from You're the Worst.
Yep.
She's great so far. I cannot wait to see her arc unfold.
And we're definitely seeing kind of a continued arcs with the main characters.
Stormfront, by the way, is like the name of that neo-Nazi organization, right?
Yep.
And is that what she is supposed to be representing?
They
or like her secret?
Well, that seems to be her secret. It's not... It's pretty...
Like, the audience are supposed to know what the deal is, but, like, people of the public are not supposed to be like, oh, she's a Nazi superhero.
It's funny because I mentioned it, and we all went right there, but I don't know, most people do.
No.
Right. It sounds like a superhero name.
Yeah.
But they're definitely going there.
Yeah, they're definitely going there.
They're just doing some cool stuff with other characters. I'm liking seeing Maeve, or Queen Maeve.
Their Wonder Woman, basically.
Yeah, get a little bit more interesting backstory with her.
Is it raucous and violent?
It is, but not always. Like, it's It's definitely more subdued than
Interesting. I assume that the answer would be like a wild affirmative yes.
No, there's bits. Homelander does something pretty awful to their Daredevil stand-in.
Yep.
Which is very, very visceral and violent.
Stormfront does some awful things.
But those are the like moments. There's a moment like that in every episode.
There's a ship that does something horrible to
them. Oh, yeah. Like, bad things happen, and they're definitely, they show that superheroes are dangerous and violent.
But it's not like heads being crushed every 10 minutes.
No. It is definitely not that.
Interesting.
No. It has more sophistication.
I thought it might be heads being crushed every 10 minutes.
No, no. I mean, keep in mind, this is the guy that's Supernatural.
Yeah.
He's got some skills. And
I wasn't sure. This is, what's this run on?
Amazon Prime.
Okay. I kind of figured, like, maybe with the ratings turned off that he might have cut loose and gone crazy.
It's one of their better shows.
He's definitely cutting loose.
Yeah.
But
yeah, Randy, I know you've been critical of Amazon. Do you feel this is one of their stronger outings?
This is one of their better shows.
Yeah. What were you saying, Nick?
He's definitely cutting loose, but he still knows what makes good television.
Okay.
And he doesn't, it's not like turn to 11 and
then it's not pure lurid pulp.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, but it's good, and I'm looking forward to more of it.
I'm anxiously waiting every Friday.
Yeah. And the other thing we're going to talk about, also awful, but real, is The Vow over on HBO. This is another one of their documentary series.
Yeah.
This is about, and this is a comic book tie-in, sort of.
It does.
It's about the sex cult that Allison Mack of Smallville was running.
It's called...
Was she running or just participating
She
in?
Was definitely involved.
Okay, so it all sort of focuses... The first episode is... You can almost see where these people get people to latch onto.
So basically, this is called...
Nexium.
Nexium. And it is a seminar of unleash your inner power. They've got this very smart guy.
Nexium is like that drug for, what do you call
it's
it?
It's spelled differently. Essentially like unlock your inner potential.
Yeah, it comes a little Scientology.
Yeah.
But it also feels like any kind of like Seven Habits of Successful Business People.
Right.
Like
there's a lot of overlap in those.
A mentor training kind of thing. There's this guy who's a very smart guy who has a lot of... he's very good at making it sound like he has a ton of credits when he actually doesn't.
Right.
What's his name? Dennis? No. Whatever the guy's name is. Something Lanier or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't remember his name. I should, because his tattoos are in the brand that they brand all the women with.
Yeah.
But anyway, he sort of like brings in this guy who's an indie documentary filmmaker, who made some documentary film, I don't remember what the name of it was, and that guy basically recruits a bunch of people into it, and they get into Hollywood, and basically they're doing this thing, it's like all these business seminars and unlock your inner power, and they sort of use that to segue into making a subset of women into like this dom sub cult.
Yeah.
That seemed like it was being run by women for women, but turned out to be basically funneling women into having sex with the founder.
Yeah. Isn't it Keith something?
Keith something. Keith Lanier, I think, or something. Keith Rainier.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the brand. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah.
I already kind of like vaguely knew about this, of course, but it's kind of horrific to hear about again.
What's interesting about the documentary is that it views this from the outside in because people have left this cult. And it's the documentary filmmaker, it's his wife,
yeah,
which is a notable person from Star Wars.
So the person who made the documentary, this actual documentary called Vow?
The person who was...
Working for the cult.
So the reason they have this... This guy was like the number two at the cult, basically. Or pretty high up.
He was high up, but I don't know.
They recruited him. He didn't know what was going on.
Right.
He thought he was doing this self-help seminar thing.
Right. Next thing you know, he's like...
He married a woman who was in... played Aunt Beru in episode 3.
Oh, weird.
And she became part of the cult.
Yep.
And they... this whole thing... The reason they got caught is because the guy he brought in to be like one of their big guys... is a documentary filmmaker who, as a matter of just habit, recorded literally everything in his life on audio and or video.
Yeah.
So they have all this footage because this guy recorded his whole life.
This is by the way, the stuff that found footage movies dream of.
Yeah.
Like, you need somebody who films everything so you can film all the scary shit.
It's skeevy.
But it actually happened.
I mean, obviously skeevy, of course. But it's just, like all HBO documentaries, it's so well done.
It's super compelling.
Is it
a single movie or is it a miniseries?
It's six episodes so far.
It's just like, holy shit. Because this is not that far back. It's what, 2016?
Well, the cult is still running.
Yeah,
it's running it from prison.
Yeah, and it involves, like, Allison Mack.
I don't see how people in the year 2020 can find any relation to cult-like activities and slavish devotion.
Yeah.
How am I, an average person, going to connect?
But, so the interesting thing is, like, Allie Mack is seen in background shots.
Yeah.
But we don't really see. They don't really talk to her because she's involved in this heavily. But
well, they're definitely all friends with her. I mean, yeah. They've been to her house. They talk with her on a regular basis.
Well, what it looks like is she got recruited in heavily high up, and then he basically turned her into his
slave,
pimp slave. I mean,
that's brand, what they outright call them slaves.
The brand had her initials in it. Like yep. She was. People want to give her a pass, like, oh, well, she didn't know what she was doing. She clearly knew what she was doing.
Yeah, this sounds a lot like,
well, there's
who was the who's the creepy lady who's in prison right now who was, like, getting girls, grooming them for What's-His-Face?
Yeah. Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yeah, this sounds like a variant of that. And, like, yeah, you know, when you're at that point, you know what you're doing.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, I feel bad for them falling under the sway, but they also did awful things.
Yeah, the first two episodes are very much kind of like the corporation.
I'm going to have to check this out. This sounds fascinating.
The corporation and the sort of pyramid scheme-esque-ness of them earning these,
not tassels.
Oh, God.
Yeah, there's a color-coded version of... scarves.
There's a name for it, but I don't know what it is.
Oh, wow.
And then the third episode...
that's their little achievements unlocked stuff. Yeah. Was like, oh my God.
Because they're basically... This is their job. And this is how they're making money.
There's like a multi-level marketing aspect to it. Like, you are a slave to someone, and then you get slaves under you. And it's supposed to be like, well, yeah, you do what I say, and what I'm going to say is all going to be good for you.
Well, and
just
you
not.
Do it because you have to give them blackmail. And you have to do it every week.
What do you mean you have to?
You have to make up stuff. Like, they had them say things. Like, one of these women, I saw an article about this, that basically she had her collateral, which is what they call it. She basically said that her husband was abusing their kids.
Mm-hmm.
She said that her father had molested her. Basically, she just made shit up and recorded it so that they could then release that and just, like, destroy them.
Wow, that's horrible. Yep. Also horrible because it, like, real victims will have less credibility because of this crazy
it's
cult
insidious.
Shit.
It's insidious. It is deeply dark and disturbing, but also super compelling to watch.
Okay.
I was gonna say, it's very good.
I'll check it out. The Vow.
All right. That'll about wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next time with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.